This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
We are going to do something here. We're going to start something new. I'm not talking about the order of the service being a little different, but there's nothing wrong with that. If you have emails, complaint emails about the order of the service, direct those to Aaron, of course. Not to me. All right. I'll give you some other stuff you can email me about. Okay, just hang on. I'll get to some stuff. No, and the new thing here is this book. So we're going to look a little while at the book known as Hebrews. Are you familiar? Now, you've heard of it. I hope maybe more than heard of it. I know some of you. I don't know. Maybe some of you might have even memorized it. I mean, unless your name's Harold, probably not. Right? Nobody's going to raise their hand anyway. Well, we will take some time. And if you're not familiar, you become familiar. We're going to try to take some time to look at it. How much time will we take? I don't know. I never know. And I will not ever be bold enough to presume. Just a while. Now, what I can't do, and what I certainly won't do, because I can't do it, is to go meticulously, carefully through the book, week by week, the way I, you know, ordinarily would be prone to want to get, you know, to dive in and do that. And the reason is because we've been doing this for 3 years. And that really doesn't fly anymore. There was a time, you might know this, that certain preachers and some of the sort of famous preachers in the past would approach a book of the Bible and they would decide, I'm going to preach through this book. And it'd be in it for 6 years. Yes, that would happen. It sounds a little odd to us now, and I don't know if people could abide it anymore. But they used to do it, and in fact, that's almost what you would have to do. If you were really, really going to dig into a book, especially a pretty long book and very detailed book like Hebrews, it's got a lot of content. It's not one of the more light reads. It's very theological, so you would be in it a while. So how long? I don't know. But enough to get to hit a lot of the high points, to get a good idea of the main thrust and point of the text. So we'll be doing it. And we'll start right at the top. Okay, so if you're looking it up, somewhere back there around the Timothy and the James region, you're going to find it. But we'll start here at the very beginning of it, 1:1, and it reads like this. Hebrews 1 says, long ago, at many times, and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom He also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and He upholds the universe by the word of His power. This is the inspired word, beginning of the letter to Hebrews. What is this book about? I got it. We got to take a little time for background. In fact, we won't even get that much to the actual subject that the title indicates, because there's enough just to give you about the book and some background to eat up some of this time. But I got to do it so we know what we're looking at. You know, it is important to understand some background of what we read so that the Bible doesn't become a magic token of mystical sentences here and there that you quote to ward off the spirits. It's not like that. They're actual texts. They are complete texts. They're coherent. They have themes. They make a point. There are arguments laid out. It's not just sort of like a ritual text with words of power that strung together correctly accomplish things. There's a little bit of a teaching like that in some circles. And this is how the Bible is used. If not used as a physical item itself, hold it up and make the demons fly away. You know, press it to your chest and help the healing begin. The actual book itself becomes a physical magic token of some kind. But we're looking at a text. So what is its background? This book, known as the Letter to the Hebrews, it is a general epistle, they call it. A general epistle. Epistle just means a letter. So if you've ever written a letter to somebody, then you wrote an epistle. Right? Maybe you wrote First and Second Girlfriend. Huh? Something like that? Yeah. Or maybe you wrote First Congressman, all right, to complain about something. You wrote a letter before. You got out your pen and you got all epistolary about it. right? You wrote an epistle. So it's a general epistle, that which means it has a general audience. That means there's nobody specified. It's not like
to Timothy, my servant. It's not to
there's no specific guy that it's written to, like we see in some other places, nor is it to a specific church.
To the church at Ephesus. It's not like that. In fact, you read the beginning. We just read the opening.
Did you see anything in those words about your sort of customary introductory stuff that we find in a lot of the letters that we read? Who it's to? Nothing. It just
takes off, right? It just launches right into its content, to its subject matter. And many times, in many ways in the past, this is right to it.
So there is none of that, which means we're not told who this was to exactly originally. Incidentally, we're also not informed of who's writing it. More on that in a minute. But now, the text itself, if you read through it, gives some indications about who it's for and who it's to specifically. I mean, like most of these, you might expect it's to people who are Christians. I mean, it's largely to Christian believers. I say largely because there's some reason to think that its intent is also so that some others who are non-Christians might sort of see it, might hear it, might read it, and there might be some good done for them. But of course, it assumes a largely Christian audience. But it assumes an audience of believers who specifically, if they don't have specifically a Jewish background, they're at least keenly interested in the theology coming from what we call the Old Testament, from all those scriptures, and in putting it together. And so therefore, some people say, well, it's to a community of Christians who, you know, Jewish believers. You know, sometimes people are offended by the idea that you could have Christians of Jewish origin, Messianic Jews. So, well, how dare you? I always think, man, all the first ones were. This movement would have never got off the ground, right, without that. In fact, it's funny because originally it was a little bit of a hurdle to get over that you could have Christians who weren't Jews. They had to sort of fight about that. Now we have people offended that there can be Christians who are Jews, you know, by birth. So this book, then, because of its content, people say, well, maybe that's... But of course, it could be for everybody, because isn't it important that all Christians have an awareness and understanding of the doctrinal roots and background, theological categories? Shouldn't they know those things? They should know those things. So we're not exactly sure who it was. By extension, incidentally, as I said, it could serve as a tool to maybe persuade specifically some people on the fence, some of those who had their Jewish background but weren't quite sure. Is this man the Messiah? Is this really the fulfillment? And if they read Hebrews, they'd get a good dose of a pretty robust argument that yes, it was. So it could have that apologetic element to defend Christian belief and that evangelistic element to persuade people. It's a book that's versatile then. It's a text that could accomplish quite a bit. Well, how about the theology? Before we talk about the mystery of the author, let's talk a little bit about the beliefs. The theology, as I said, is weighty. I mean, there's a lot of meat in this book. It's very significant. In fact, the weight of the doctrinal content of Hebrews has served to make a lot of teachers and preachers a little leery of it, a little weary of it, a little intimidated by it. Sometimes they don't want to dive into it. Sometimes they're a little worried about getting into the tall weeds of this book because there's just so much theology to sort out. And there are a few passages that we would classify as hard passages where the interpretation is difficult and you have people on different sides. And so some people will avoid it. The great William Barclay called this book the most difficult book in the New Testament. But of course, its value has always been recognized. And there's never been any doubt about the worth of it. Because, as I said, more than any other text, the book of Hebrews builds a theological bridge between Old Covenant and New Covenant, between the Testament. Sort of links them, it connects the dots like nothing else did. Calvin said that there is indeed no book in Holy Scripture that so fully explains that Christ is the end of the law. No book does that better. No book puts a finer point on that than this one does. So you have George Guthrie, Union University Bible professor. He says this about it. Of all the writings, he says, of the New Testament, none is more saturated with overt references to the Old Testament. The author so filled his discourse with Old Testament thoughts and passages that they permeate every chapter. 35 quotations from a Greek translation of the Old Testament and 34 allusions work to support the development of Hebrews' argument. In addition, the writer offers 19 summaries of Old Testament material, and 13 times he mentions an Old Testament name or topic. This writer knew those scriptures, knew them well. But who was it? Ah, there's a question. Who was it? This is an oldie. It's been much discussed way back from the beginning, and it's never really been quite solved, never really been quite known. Nobody has had the definitive case to make so that there would be a consensus and people would say, okay, that's the author. Well, who then are the candidates, though? Let's talk about some of our options. I didn't invent these. These go back a long way. So here are some possibilities people have offered. You read some of these commentaries, you know, on Hebrews, you'll find them dealing with all these possibilities. So you got Paul. There's Barnabas. There's Apollos. You got Luke. And Silas. Aquila and or Priscilla. They're a married couple, so they're grouped together. And then this guy, Clement of Rome. Say a few things about some of these possibilities. And of course, we have to start at the top with Paul. Where else are you going to start? Because Paul is often sort of just the default. When in doubt, you just sort of, you fall back on Paul. I didn't mean for that to rhyme. You just kind of default to the man, the apostle, the great writer. And why? Why not? He's obviously such a great writer and a prolific one, and wrote during this time to all these churches with authority and with great knowledge. He knew the background. He was a great learned Pharisee and knew his Greek. And Hebrews is written in pretty fine Greek, so they tell us. And so maybe Paul. I mean, if you go read the end, jump ahead and read the very last passage in the whole book, that'll sound like Paul to you. When you go and read the very end of Hebrews, you'll see that, you know, he gives those kind of salutations, and he mentions Timothy by name, and he offers a very typical sounding benediction, which we will close our service with today, so you'll hear it. It sounds like Paul. Some of the sentence structure sounds what they say, it's Pauline. That's not a lady named Pauline. That means it's sort of Paul. Well, maybe it's Paul. When I was growing up, people would just assume it was Paul. And indeed, the early Christians, they'd take the manuscripts, they'd kind of bind them. The manuscripts would be grouped up. It's like all the Gospels were always grouped together. So some of the early church, you would often find Hebrews grouped in there with Paul's letters. So maybe it's Paul, and that'd sort of be an easy way to go. However, there are some odd, peculiar things about this text that make some people say, maybe it's not Paul this time. As I said a minute ago, we don't have any introduction. If this is Paul's letter, it's the only one he wrote where he decided, I'm not going to say who I am. He always did that before. He would say, it's Paul here, Paul writing to you. He'd make it clear who it was. And he would always say who it's to. He'd be very specific about it. And he'd always give customary greetings. You know, those kind of nice greetings about how, you know, I thank my God and Father for you. And, you know, nice sounding stuff. There's none of that in Hebrews. It's just gone. So that makes people wonder, Paul write this? I mean, doesn't sound like what he normally does. He might have had a reason for not doing that. It just sounds like a treatise, really, not one of his letters. The Greek in some places, again, so we are told, sounds a little bit different. Some of the themes of Hebrews you don't find anywhere else in Paul's stuff. Some of the emphases are different. Also, there's this. In chapter 2, verse 3, the writer of Hebrews says, and I quote, "This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him." That doesn't sound like a thing Paul would say. Paul always put himself with the first hearers. Remember how he said, oh, more than once, I'm an apostle. I mean, I heard him myself. Sure, I came along kind of late, as though one untimely born. But just as much as the other guys, Jesus spoke to me personally, directly. I mean, he appeared. He talked to me. I heard his voice. Here, this writer seems to be sort of sounding kind of secondhand about it, right? And that makes some people wonder. Well, what about some of these other possibilities? I mean, if Paul's not the guy, certainly most of the writers on this possible writers here are in the constellation of Paul. Notice how many of these people are Paul's associates and the people who worked with him. Barnabas, his traveling companion early on. Remember him? Barnabas. Barnabas, the son of encouragement, was one of Paul's guys. Some people say it was him. Down a little further, you got Silas. Not as many people think Silas, but he's sort of the later companion, right? You've got Luke, who often traveled with him. Good old Luke, who the writer of his gospel and Acts. Maybe it's Luke. How about Apollos? Remember, Apollos, well-spoken, very well-learned man. And the guy who apparently was a gifted speaker. Remember, Paul, when he writes to Corinth, and they got a problem in Corinth. They got a lot of problems in Corinth. But remember, one of their problems was they had factions. And some people were saying, I am of Paul. And some people were saying, I am of Apollos. He was influential enough to have a faction of some people that thought that he was the man. Incidentally, Luther took this view. He thought Apollos was the writer of Hebrews. And then you've got Aquila and Priscilla, who met Paul and worked alongside Paul. And, of course, Priscilla would be of particular interest. You would have a female writer of a New Testament book. Now, of course, one of the oldest jokes that preachers always love to tell is that, that it's very well likely that a woman would have been the writer of this book. Because after all, this is after 13 long, very wordy chapters, and in 13:22, the writer says, I have written to you briefly. Don't hate me, ladies. Don't email me. So, maybe it would be like a woman to say, I have written to you briefly after such a long, long text. You want to know if this is something people talk about the writer. This is an old discussion. In fact, just last week, you might know that in this room last week, there was some goings on. And, they had a little ordination service. So I'm standing near Dr. Johnson, and David Kendall is reading, and he's talking about, he mentioned Hebrews, and he's saying some things about Hebrews, and as he's talking, he says, Paul reminds us of this, or Paul reminds us of that. So I leaned kind of in and whispered to Dr. J, I said, but was it Paul? Just kind of horsing around. And he leaned back over to me and he said, nah, it was Barnabas. And so I leaned back over to him and said, well, maybe it was Apollos. And so then he leaned back over to me and he said, I like to think it was Priscilla. And so it goes. So you see, this is an oldie. This is something people have talked about a lot. Let me mention, by the way, this last guy here. You're wondering, who's this guy? Clement of Rome. Clement was one of the earliest church fathers. He was thought to have known Peter and Paul both. He served in Rome, as the name indicates. And so they say that there's some tradition says Peter appointed him there. And he's probably the Clement that Paul mentions in Philippians by name. Clement was a convert, became a believer, rose to leadership. He wrote this important letter. Actually, it was a very widely valued and prized letter. You can read it today. It was written in the year 96 to the church in Corinth. And in that letter that Clement wrote to them, he actually alludes to the book of Hebrews in it. Now, that's not the only reason some people made the connection to him. By the way, Clement was ultimately martyred. So he's considered sort of one of those great saints who went from leadership to death in short order with the Emperor Trajan. Tradition says that he was first imprisoned in a stone quarry. And then later they went ahead and killed him they tied him to an anchor and tossed him into the Black Sea. You'll find some of the old early church paintings that depict Clement being tossed into the sea. So just another one of the possibilities. Well, what are we to say about this? What do we do with this? We have these possibilities. Well, look, clearly the author of this book intends to be anonymous. He meant not to say. But why? I don't know. He didn't say why he meant not to say. It doesn't say, I don't want to say who I am because of this reason or that. It just doesn't say. And so nobody has ever clearly known. It's kind of funny. Back in one of the earliest church histories written by a guy, Eusebius, early historian. And Eusebius wrote a thing called A History of the Church, which, of course, at that point wasn't much of a history. It was written in the 4th century, around 325, they say, the Nicaea year. So in his history of the church, he makes a mention of the book of Hebrews and the fact that we don't know, considering, you know, who might have written it. And he quotes the great first century scholar, Origen of Alexandria, who said, quote, "But as to who wrote the epistle to the Hebrews, God knows the truth of the matter." And that's sort of where it stands from Origen on. God knows the truth of the matter. We don't. But one thing is clear, lest you mistake it, that from the earliest days, the church was, there was a fairly solid consensus in the church that Hebrews had apostolic authority and agreement, and that they endorsed it. Now, you would always be a few people that would say, no, 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 because without that name on there, you know, to have that apostolic authority, we want to know that there's a name of an apostle somewhere on it or somebody connected. But I should remind you to remember this. Luke, was Luke considered one of the apostles? And yet Luke-Acts, which were together one text early on, one bound book, they're considered fully authoritative. So the earliest believers spoke of these writings, and when they talked about Hebrews and when they quoted from Hebrews, even not knowing the author completely, they quoted it as though scripture. They didn't quote the other early fathers, like Clement's letter, that letter I mentioned. No one ever talked about Clement's letter with that same voice, with that same reference. They didn't. There was a difference, you know. It's important. It's valuable. It has good wisdom in it. But they didn't consider it inspired. They didn't consider it passing the test, the rule, what they called the canon, you know, that guideline that says these are inspired texts. In Hebrews, they always thought was. So, to sort of sum up this whole business here of who we are dealing with about this writer, we'll let Craig Keener be the guy to kind of like resolve this for us, to give you a good quote from Craig Keener, scholar of the New Testament. And he says this about the writer. He says, from the contents of the letter of the Hebrews, there are a number of things we can say about the author. One is that he was brilliant. Of course, Keener must not think it was Priscilla, huh? One is that he was brilliant. He knew the Septuagint. Now, this is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. He quotes it directly, word for word. He knew that, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, backward and forward. He knew how to link texts in ways that were very persuasive to traditional Jewish audiences. Probably he was a Hellenistic Jewish author writing to a Hellenistic Jewish audience. When I say Hellenistic Jewish, I mean Greek speaking. And probably in the diaspora, that means like all the Jews spread out outside of, you know, outside of the Holy Land. But very committed to their Jewish traditions and very knowledgeable in Scripture. So, here you have it, the book known as Hebrews. So now let's circle back to these opening lines and just say a few words that give us a clue about its main emphasis. Because what we can derive from looking at those opening lines again that we read, those first words, already, just in the first few verses, we can already get a good dose of the primary emphasis. If we want to, you know, if you wanted to sort of distill a primary theme, you get it already in the opening verses. Just look at them again here, okay? Just to remind us what we read. Long ago, at many times and many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken by His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and upholds the universe by the word of His power. This captures the main theme. It gives you a big clue as to what's coming in all the chapters. And what is it essentially? How would we summarize it? To say simply this, that Jesus, that the Messiah, that Christ Himself is greater, better, bigger, more important, superior in all ways. He is, as it says in chapter 3 of the book, The apostle and high priest. As it says in chapter 12, He is the author and finisher of our faith. And it says a whole lot of other things that we'll look at some of those. In fact, it lays it out something like an argument to say, piece by piece, that all the great things that you love, revealed through all those scriptures and all those generations, They're all good. To say that Jesus surpasses them and is greater is not to look down on, and not to belittle, and not to hold in slight regard all of the old things of old. The covenants, the law, the prophets, the temple, the sacrifice, all of that. He is not degrading those things, or downsizing those things, or making less of those things. He's simply making much, much more of the Messiah who has come, to say that Jesus comes and fulfills and surpasses and exceeds and is better and is greater. This is essentially the theme of the book. This is what it's about. To quote good old Chuck Swindoll, says like this: throughout its pages, Hebrews makes clear that Jesus Christ exceeds all other people, pursuits, objects, or hopes to which human beings offer allegiance. Hebrews pictures Jesus as better than the angels, as bringing better lives to humanity through salvation, as offering a better hope than the Mosaic law could promise, as a better sacrifice for our sins than a bull or a goat, and as providing a better inheritance in heaven for those who place their faith in Him. Jesus is indeed superior to all others. That's a good cliff note. In that case, it was a Chuck note. All right? When I summarize things, I say, here's the Clint note version. I think some people in here don't even know what cliff notes were. Because now you got the internet. But before the internet, we had to buy these little things. Never mind. Talk about it later. Shouldn't put ideas in your head. But we don't want to cliff note our way through the Bible, of course. We don't substitute it. But it's good to get a nice, distillation sometimes. You know? Because we're gonna get into some of the nitties and the gritties of it as week to week we look at some things. But even the whole time you're looking at this isolated passage here, or this diving into this verse here, the whole time, you know, you want to keep the big picture in your mind, you know? You know how you do Google Maps? How many of you, when you look at Google Maps, you're like always going out and in and out and in? You know what I'm saying? Like, especially if you're directionally challenged, you're like zero in and then you back out. You're like zero in and back out 45 times, just trying to get your bearings. Now, where is that? Okay, it's right here. Okay, I got to back out and get an idea where. Now, which highway is that by? I mean, some of you, it takes you a long time. But there's nothing wrong with the text of doing a lot of out and in kind of stuff. Like, what's the main overarching argument? What argument am I in the middle of here? What is he laying out here? Okay, good. Now back to these few words. What does he mean by those few words? Let me back up again. You know? That's okay. That's a good way to study. So, what I listed as a topic, we'll say more about, because I didn't give much chance, but you saw it in the opening lines. We're starting by saying that as far as Revelation goes, you know, God speaks to man, that there's no higher. This is the first superior thing about Jesus that he mentions right in the opening verses. He doesn't waste any time getting to his point. Jesus is superior. And in that case, he's saying superior to revelation that came through prophets, revelation that came through the Torah, revelation that came through a dream and a vision to somebody, which happened sometimes, you know. All the revelations that happened, this is the greatest revelation of them all. This is flesh and blood. He spoke through his son. So already there's the superiority. Well, I'll close it out here with the words of R.C. Sproul, who captures pretty well, the late R.C. Sproul, who captures this idea. He says, I have often said that if I were thrown in prison and in solitary confinement, and was allowed to have only one book, the book I would want to have would be the Bible. Now, that's a very Christian thing for him to say, obviously. But, he goes on, but if my options were even further restricted, and I was permitted to have only one book of the Bible, the book that I would choose would be the book of Hebrews. Now, Sproul says, this often surprises people who know me, because they assume that the book I would want to have would be Romans. But the reason Hebrews is the book that I would choose is because it so richly and comprehensively integrates all of the teaching of the Old Testament with the material that is found in the New Testament, serving as the best connecting link between the two. It is also one of the finest books of the New Testament, indeed of the entire Bible, in terms of its literary quality. The book of Hebrews also gives us a very high Christology, since the central theme is the supremacy of Christ. In Hebrews, Christ is compared to various people and things and is shown to be superior to them all. This theme, this central theme, is the supremacy of Christ. He is superior to all that have gone before him, to the angels, to Moses, to Aaron, to the Old Covenant, and indeed to all the heroes of the faith who lived under the Old Covenant. The writer of the Hebrews plays his hand right at the beginning of the book. And as we read, in fact, he did play his hand right at the beginning of this book. May God bless the future study that we will make of it, and challenge us, and teach us, and give us real solid growth.
Whatever things are lovely, whatever things are true, whatever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, let us think upon these things. Let God be true and every man a liar. And that is what it comes down to.